Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. It's the third day of May, 2017. You know, I've been in Washington, D.C. all week. However, I'm traveling today, so I put together kind of a special program for you. We began our week here in D.C. with an issues forum, an opportunity for all of those that represent different agricultural interests in the Capitol to discuss their policy issues with those of us who report on them. Today, we'll hear about ethanol, exports, millennials, immigration, and biodiesel.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Let's start our roundtable set of conversations this afternoon with ethanol and the RFS, its approval process that happens annually. Growth Energy's Chris Bliley was on hand. He's their Vice President of Regulatory Affairs.
What do you think about E15 and its ability to move into the system?
Yeah, I think E15, while it hasn't come as quick as everyone would have liked, I think we're seeing a great deal of success very recently. In fact, today we had Quick Trip announced that they're adding E15 at between 400 and 500 locations in their footprint. We've seen a number of major independent retailers here in the Mid-Atlantic. We have Sheetz selling E15 in Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, North Carolina. We're seeing more and more growth. While obviously it's relatively small, we're at 800 locations in 29 states. It's been important, and we're also seeing strong sales, not only of E15, but those locations are also selling E85 side by side. And at those locations, we're seeing blend rates well north of 10%, shattering this notion that there is a blend wall at 10%.
It's important to note not all cars can run E15, only those after 2001.
But it's important to note that that's 9 out of every 10 cars on the road are 2001 or newer. We're also seeing that the auto manufacturers are warranting more and more of their vehicles on E15. But if you take a poll of everybody in this room who drives a car older than 2001, it's very few people. As I said, it's 9 out of 10 cars on the road are approved for E15. We wouldn't expect any problems. Some of it had to do with the way EPA tested the fuel. We obviously saw it E15 for all engines, not only passenger vehicles, but off-road engines as well, because we don't think there'd be any problems. But that's the way it was approved, and that's the way we've moved forward since then.
Chris Bliley is the VP of Regulatory Affairs for Growth Energy.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really, thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with 5 other voices, Joe Vaklovic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzalem. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news. Oh, and thank you. Thank you so much for listening. Well, you're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason. Today, we're listening to conversations from Washington, D.C. We started our program with ethanol. Our list still includes immigration, marketing to millennials, biodiesel, and up next, exports.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're joined now by the President and CEO of the U.S. Grains Council, Tom Slate. Tom, thank you so much for being with us and for coming here to the National Association of Farm Broadcasting's annual Washington Watch event, and we do appreciate it.
Always good to see you here, Todd. Enjoy it.
So tell me a little bit about what the U.S. Grains Council does for farmers in the United States.
Very simply, you know, we're their voice overseas. We're their voice in the overseas market. I like to say 24/7, 365, somebody from the U.S. Grains Council is out there representing and selling and taking care of our customers and helping grow the markets of tomorrow for U.S. corn, sorghum, and barley.
Last week, there was a potentially big problem for U.S. corn growers, others in the United States, and grains, as the president had decided he was going to revoke NAFTA through an executive order. Many of the associations in agriculture came together, said, wait a second, Mr. President, we don't think that's a good idea. Sonny Perdue, the brand new Secretary of Agriculture, sat down with him. Looks like that all worked. However, we have to move forward from here, and he still says, if we don't get a deal, I'll pull out. How much of a problem does this create? In Washington, D.C., what are the thoughts?
Well, you know, it was a really call to action, really. I made the big mistake. My phone was low. I had to charge my phone. So I went out to get some lunch. By the time I came back, my phone was fully charged from all the incoming emails I had gotten because it happened so quickly. And again, you know, we're just very concerned, for particularly for us, number one market for corn, a number two market for DDGs, number two market for sorghum, number one market for barley. You know, and suddenly withdrawing from NAFTA had all the wrong consequences for those important markets to us. So it's a matter of, you know, assembling, you know, saying, hey, we've got to get our message out and get it out quickly to try to turn this tide, because that's what we're supposed to be doing. And we did. And we did, and other commodities did, because, again, we have to demonstrate every day the importance of trade to agriculture and the importance of agriculture to the U.S. economy. That message has been kind of, you know, sort of idling right now while we hadn't had, you know, secretary in place, didn't have a you know, U.S. trade ambassador in place. So, yeah, I mean, so we had to make sure we got out and got out quickly and got out right and got out vigorously.
How important is it that the president tweeted about this up front? Did that give you the heads up for everybody to move into action?
Yeah, a lot of people were asking me that question. Is this art of the deal type of stuff? Is this sort of something to sort of, you know, get the conversation going in a different way? I don't know what it was, and, you know, quite frankly, it doesn't matter, because our job was to go out there and defend U.S. corn farmers, barley farmers, sorghum farmers, DDG producers, ethanol producers. All of them were really important. But yeah, you know, a lot of people ask me about that. Is this part of the negotiation?
Well, I'm wondering not about whether it's part of the negotiation, but whether simply the fact that he tweeted about it, did you know about it because he tweeted about it? And if he hadn't tweeted, how much of a problem might that have been?
Well, we picked up on it on a press report from Politico is where they first got it. That's where we first heard it. And so, you know, whether that was a result of a tweet or what, you know, again, that happens a lot in Washington. You know, people like float trial balloons, you know, that question was asked. But I kind of discounted that because I don't think, you know, President Trump is a big trial balloon floater. And so we knew that was serious, and we knew we had to get after it.
What other things are on your issues list?
Well, I think it's a, you know, kind of a continuing, evolving list, because Korea, you know, they're going after the CORUS agreement, the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. And so we're hearing a lot of that concern from other buyers around the world. You know, what's going to happen with our relationship with the United States in terms of trade? Colombia, we heard a little bit about it. But beyond that, we're also out there, we have to build new demand. We have to find new demand, we have to build new demand. And so we're making sure we stay focused on that task, because that's the most important one. Yeah, we got to watch these trade agreements and trade policies very, very closely, but we also have to build demand concurrently. And so when we're looking at places like we call Frontier Asia, Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, Bangladesh, India, places like that aren't normal markets, we've got to make sure we're doing an aggressive job doing that, an aggressive job going after the value-added markets as well, including ethanol.
So India is an interesting prospect, 1.1 billion people and growing there, a very large country, but a very large agricultural industry there, which produces enough wheat to export. What are you hoping the U.S. Grains Council can help them look at and convince them to import from the United States?
Yeah, I think it's a matter of, this is what we've done over the years, Todd, you know, develop the market, work with these industries, like for instance, livestock industries, meat industries, starch industries, ethanol industries, work with them on how they can develop to help better and feed, better supply their, you know, local economy, but also knowing full well that we're going to, U.S. will be there to supply the gap if, you know, demand exceeds supply, which it almost always does. So the dynamics in India are very strong in terms of, you know, population growth, in terms of economic growth. And so it's the same sort of thing we saw in China, you know, 25 years ago. So we're like planting those seeds in that market. It's still a long ways to go in the Indian market, but we'll get there someday.
One last question, and this is related to India. We know that as China's population began to build wealth, move into the middle class, their middle class is about the same size as the whole of the U.S.
Right.
population. India should be roughly the same, maybe even larger, I would think. However, will they or won't they have the same propensity to want to eat red meats?
70% of Indians eat meat right now. It happens. They won't eat the same array of meats. I mean, actually, it's their largest dairy consumer and country in the world, number one, right now, already. Chicken's growing very, very fast. Yeah, they're not going to be eating a lot of beef and things like that. But other products, they'll be right there. Not as quickly as other places, but again, that growth will be there and it will come. And it's going to create a critical mass for U.S. agriculture in years to come.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Todd, anytime. Good to see you.
Tom Slate is with the U.S. Grains Council, where he serves as their president and CEO. I'm Todd Gleason. We're at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting's Washington Watch.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's Ag Programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.
The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media. Do find us online at WILLAG.org. That's willag.org this week. We've been in Washington, D.C. More discussions coming up. Next, we'll talk with Kelly Bray. She's with Crop Life America, and they've been looking at millennials. You've got a brand new social media campaign targeted at what audience?
Targeted more to consumers, to a young audience, people who maybe haven't given any thought about crop protection or pesticide products, but a way to open a conversation and give a cause for pause.
So we often look for the hashtags. This one is hashtag give a crop. And it really is kind of what it sounds like. And you're really just playing on the words here, trying to get a message out about the kinds of pesticides that farmers generally use in their fields and some of the reasons behind it.
Our industry is so heavily regulated, is also so scientific that sometimes it can get very lengthy, a discussion of why or how we use products, or how they're regulated. This is the opposite. This is just a funny little blip into that pest in the office, that guy you can't get rid of at the family holiday party or maybe your neighborhood holiday party. And maybe you don't have a choice in what you do with that person. But when it comes to a pest or a weed in a field, a farmer does have some choices, and that's where crop protection comes in.
So you're using this to reach what audience?
To a younger audience, definitely. Really putting out some of the videos that we have on our website, on social media channels, Facebook. We've got some Instagram photos that we're using, different infographics. Really reaching that younger audience again to create that cause for pause. Just get people thinking.
Are you thinking millennials in this case?
Yes, absolutely. You know, the reactions that we have seen when we show some of these videos is very different from an older demographic versus a younger one. The younger ones, they think, you know, even if they don't agree with pesticide use, they'll still say, you know what, that was pretty clever, though. I had a chuckle out of it. And that's more than we'd get in other situations.
Is there a long-term goal or fear, either one, by Crop Life America, about the millennials and their view of the world? And I guess what I'm really driving at is, are they independent enough that they think outside of the box a lot of the time? Or maybe they herd think part of the time as well?
Well, I think there's both. I think some of what we hear about millennials is definitely that they want to make a difference in the world. They want to know that they play a part in making things better. And when they learn that by use of crop protection products, you can cut down on erosion with no-till, the precise application, that precision technology through a seed treatment, helps sometimes reduce the use for foliar application or a spray. That precision technology is so fascinating. And I hope that they will see through some of these conversations, once we've given that cause for pause, once we've been able to get deeper into the conversation, the stewardship that is involved in crop protection and all of agriculture. It's very interesting, and I think they can see the role that they play in that.
Kelly Bray is with Crop Life America. She participated in the Issues Forum in Washington, D.C. here at Washington Watch, an event that's annually put on by the National Association of Farm Broadcasting. We've been listening to some of the conversations I had on Monday of this week. Of course, I'm traveling back to Illinois today on this Wednesday afternoon. Two more conversations for the day. The next one is with Chuck Connor. You might remember him or recall his name from USDA. He's now the president and CEO of the National Council for Farmer Cooperatives. Our topic for the day, immigration. When this president came into office, he came in large part on immigration reform. Agriculture's not always been on board with where he'd like to go. Can you tell me a little bit about those places where you're segregated out from his policies?
Well, there's no question we do have a big immigration challenge, and we had it before, and certainly we have that challenge now that Donald Trump is president of the United States, given the focus that he has put on immigration and labor issues. We estimate today that as much as 70% of our hired labor force on our farms and ranches consists of individuals who may not be in this country with proper documentation. So this is not a small issue. This represents the majority of what we're all about at their labor issues. It's not a California and Florida issue like it used to be as well. It's come to the heartland, come to the Midwest, and these are problems on farms of all sizes, all shapes, and all configurations. So we've got a strong case that we have to make to solve this problem so that agriculture can do what the president says he wants us to do, which is contribute to substantial economic growth in this country, which has been pretty dismal for the last several years. The president wants to double economic growth. In order for us to contribute to that, we've got to solve this labor problem.
Why is this labor force an immigrant labor force to begin with? What is it about these jobs that Americans aren't interested in?
Well, it's been proven time and time again that these are jobs that, it's very, very difficult to find Americans who are willing to do them. And this is, jobs that range from, working in the fields in the hot California sun to caring for our livestock, being involved in, for example, dairy operations where you're literally milking, cows around the clock. This is labor in America today. And for the most part, it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to get Americans to do that kind of job, despite the importance, you know, of what it involves in terms of, you know, production of food, harvesting of, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables, all the things that we would consider essential for a quality of life. But yet within that system, you know, there needs to be this hired labor force consisting of migrant labor that not only for our existing force, but, you know, we need a system where we can renew that force as well over time as people age, transition to other jobs.
I'm going to push you on this section just a little bit. It's very hard labor. Do we know if it's pay related or is it simply the amount of time and labor that is involved?
Every study, whether a study's done by the American Farm Bureau Federation, whether studies done by the University of California, show that it is not a pay issue. And that's often thrown in our face as the core issue, but the proof is that it is not. Some of these jobs, most of these jobs are very, very high paying jobs. Way, way above any kind of minimum wage sort of rates. You know, we're way beyond that sort of thing. So these are, you know, jobs that have the potential to be very, very good paying. But again, because of, you know, what they are and the work involved, they're not jobs that Americans, you know, are willing to do.
Are you able to talk with the president and his advisors? Do you think you've made headway there?
Well, obviously, you know, it's very, very early in the process. And, you know, we are part of what's called the Agriculture Workforce Coalition. We actually chair the Agriculture Workforce Coalition, which consists of all the agricultural interests with a stake in this labor debate. And, you know, as a group, we know that it's probably not the time to be talking about specifics quite yet. But we are educating, you know, members of Congress, the new Trump administration, on the scope of the problem. And as I said, you know, as much as 70% of the labor force out there may be undocumented. For the most part, this is news, you know, to people who don't follow these things on a daily basis. They think it may be a small problem. They don't realize that it's a gigantic problem for American agriculture that does need a solution if we're going to do what we're going to continue to do.
If the solution doesn't come in a form that is acceptable to agriculture, meaning that the president is able to get immigration reform done in some form, what problems does it create?
Well, it creates labor shortages. Labor shortages mean we're not going to, you know, produce as much, we're not going to create as much economic growth out of our food and agriculture sector as what we otherwise had the potential to do. And that runs counter to everything that, in a very bipartisan way, that members of Congress and the president say they want. No one is satisfied with 2% economic growth. Everybody wants something substantially higher than that. We can contribute to that. We probably can't if we don't fix this labor problem.
That's Chuck Connor of the National Council of Farmer Cooperatives. I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. When we return, one more interview, this time biodiesel.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, offering financial products and services created specifically for the cooperative's member owners to meet the needs of rural America, including farm real estate and operating loans, crop insurance, point-of-sale financing, and risk management options, helping farm families succeed today and tomorrow.
It's National Raspberry Popover Day. The raspberry was a native bush to Turkey, and as early as the 1st century BC, was gathered from vines at the foothills of Troy. William Prince established the first raspberry plant in nurseries in the American colonies in 1737, and Luther Burbank is credited with introducing a number of raspberry hybrids into American horticulture. On this day in agricultural history in 1654, a bridge in Raleigh, Massachusetts, began charging a toll for animals while people passed for free. In 1844, William Atwater was born, an American scientist. He developed agricultural chemistry. After receiving a PhD from Yale for his studies on the chemical makeup of corn, he turned his attention to the effects of fertilizers in farming. Later, he determined the chemical makeup and nutritional values of fish and animals. In 1910, Howard Ricketts died, an American pathologist. He discovered that Rocky Mountain spotted fever is spread by cattle ticks and that typhus was caused by a similar organism carried by lice. Ironically, Ricketts died at the age of 39 in Mexico City after himself being stricken by typhus. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support for agricultural weather on WILL comes from the Friends of WILL and from Busey. With nearly 150 years of agribusiness experience, Busey offers solutions, resources, and expertise to support landowners. Busey, your dream, our promise.
I'm Todd Gleason in Washington, D.C. This is the Closing Market Report. We'll close our NAFB Issues Forum special out today by exploring another biofuel. I spoke with Ann Steckel, VP of Federal Affairs for the National Biodiesel Board.
Well, the biodiesel industry has really been a growing and dynamic, successful industry. We've really been a success story of the renewable fuel standard. A lot of people think of the RFS and they just think about ethanol. But for the biodiesel industry, we have really been a great success story. We have filled the majority of the advanced biofuels bucket, as well as the biomass-based diesel bucket. So our numbers have continued to grow. Our industry has continued to diversify, and it's been a real success story.
So as we look forward and that advanced portion grows through 2022, how much do you think you can grow the industry? Will we have to build capacity in the United States?
Well, our plants are only running at 65% capacity today. And unfortunately, because of a lot of market dynamics that have been going on, we have seen a lot of plants that have idled throughout the years because of the on and off structure of federal policy, be it the tax credits or delays in the renewable fuel standards or other things like that. It's been difficult. And for the biodiesel industry, we are still a very young and growing industry. And right now, federal policy and stable federal policy is incredibly important.
You mentioned the on and off structure. That has to do with the tax credit most often. Last week, legislation was introduced, I believe, again, to put that back into place. Where does it stand, and will it be passed?
Well, last week, Senators Cantwell and Grassley introduced legislation to extend and revise the biodiesel tax incentive. And we're very excited about this bill because it changes the structure of the tax credit from what is a blender's tax credit to a producer's tax credit. The current structure of a blender's tax credit, as it's been in years past, and says that anyone who blends the fuel has access to the dollar a gallon, meaning all of these imports that we've seen coming in have received access to our U.S. tax dollars. We think it makes a lot of sense, and obviously a number of senators agree with us that it makes a lot of sense for U.S. produced fuel to receive access to the tax credit instead of incentivizing all the foreign imports.
What are your projections for the industry with and without the tax credit?
Well, unfortunately, our industry has seen the tax credit lapse several times. The tax credit's been on, then the tax credit's been off. And so we're really hoping as the tax credit and this tax policy continues to evolve that we can get some long-term planning in place for the tax incentive. It just doesn't make sense for any business to have this on and off nature of tax policy. It makes a lot of sense for planning purposes to have some long-term stability.
Generally, when the legislation is put in place, it's retroactive for the full year. Will that be the case in this piece of legislation?
We don't know what form the tax credit's going to be taking place. I mean, Congress may not do tax policy till the end of the year, in which sense, yes, it would then be activated retroactively. If Congress, for some reason, got around to it before then some of it would be prospectively. So we, again, don't know. It's too early to say. The one message that we're saying is, though, is that it's important to have a producer's credit and have that for a number of years for planning purposes.
Ann, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Ann Steckel is with the National Biodiesel Board. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason in Washington, D.C.